This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to Studio Secrets A to Z. I'm Anthony J. Resta, your host, and this week we're jumping into part two of our Make Noise music interview with founder and CEO Tony Rolando, and we're going to jump in to talk about his music. Welcome back, Tony. I'm going to jump right into a piece from your album, Breakin' Is a Memory. It's called Broadcasting Live from the Funhouse. Here it is. We'll be right back. broadcasting live from the Funhouse. That's super cool. I could do a whole entire episode just talking about how you compose this kind of music. It's really cool. Let's get into, your philosophy on that a bit.
Oh, absolutely. For me, I just love that. For a long time, I wasn't making music myself. I just wasn't really feeling that inspiration, but I was still able to be a part of the musical conversation through the instruments that we make at Make Noise. I really enjoyed being around musicians. I enjoyed that I still got to hang out and talk with Alessandro, I haven't chatted with Heimbach quite so much, but I've met him and I've gone and seen him play shows. And so I think one of the best things about Make Noise is that I get to work with great musicians. So Robert A.A. Lowe, I was just hanging out with him up in New York City previous weekend, and he was showing me a rough cut of a documentary he just finished scoring, and he's telling me how he used Spectrophone here or there or whatever. But it's not so much that he used something that Make Noise makes, but that it's like getting to be there and he's excited about it and showing you what he's done with it. And it sounds incredible. Yeah, exactly. That's what it is. It's like you're in that moment with them.
It's cool stuff. And I really, you're very meticulous about it. And you have a mission, and I followed some of your videos in your creative process. And I wanted to ask you about like your music making journey. How's that been intertwined with the development of Make Noise, or do you feel like they're like two separate things, like being a CEO and a musician and a designer? How does that all work with for you? Like, did it just over time develop?
It came back kind of suddenly after spending so much time, especially working with Alessandro on the Strega. I mean, it's funny because Alessandro is actually younger than me by a few years, quite a few. But he has this sage-like presence, especially when it comes to music. And I feel like I was lucky enough to spend quite a bit of time with him to where a lot of that just rubbed off on me. And I felt very compelled and inspired to make music again. And it seems strange
that happens.
Pin that on one person, but I mean, that's kind of the truth. I wasn't really thinking about doing music, but it just his enthusiasm for sounds and composition and all of it, it just made me want to chase that again. And as far as how that works with Make Noise, that's a more delicate balance, because so one of the things that I learned is that I have to separate the engineering and developing side from the creative side, like the music side. Not that you can't be creative in development and engineering, because you absolutely can. It's just a different type of creativity. And the reason I need to separate them is that it can interrupt the creative flow when you're trying to play, write, compose music. If I'm working on a piece of music and I'm using a prototype, for example, and I notice a problem with how that prototype is behaving, I'm very likely to get out of the flow of making that music and go into the flow of documenting and trying to understand a way to fix, exactly, how to fix that behavior. This module isn't behaving correctly. What do we need to do? And so the way that I've found is to help with that is to not have prototypes in my music studio, leave prototypes in the engineering room. Now that doesn't mean I won't bring them in and play with them from time to time to check them out and see how they work with other things. I will. It's just, I don't leave them there. I try to I bring them in with a purpose, like, oh, I have a new firmware for the Spectrophone. I'm putting it into my system and I'm gonna test it and play with it for a while and see how it feels. But then when I'm done, I try to pull it out and not have it there while I'm working on a piece of music, because otherwise it can definitely interrupt that process, because they really are both very demanding and they don't necessarily want to work together all the time.
Sure. It's almost like a left brain, right brain kind of thing. It's like, you know, it's kind of like a battle, you know, in some respects, you know?
Yeah. It's, see, I feel like I use both. I feel like I would use both left and right in developing a module. It's just that a module, I think my responsibilities at Make Noise are enough to where they have the capability of interrupting almost anything. So
sure. Well, that's, yeah, it's a big company. Now, how many people do you guys have working for you now at this point?
We're usually hovering around 15. And then we have contract manufacturers that we use in Atlanta and LA. And then also we get some parts made in Chicago. We used to use a place in Florida, but during the pandemic, they are, I don't think they're serving us anymore. I think we had to go somewhere else for that. But there's in the building, there's usually 15 people or so.
I see. Do you guys find a typical design creation process? Is it like something that you've developed over the years where you have, okay, this is the flow chart, how this is going to happen? Or do you feel like each project is going to have its own flow chart kind of thing?
I think some of the staff here would love it if we had a real organized flow chart type process, but I'm all over the place and usually chasing five things at once. And then of those five things, one might actually see the light of day. So yeah, unfortunately we don't really have like a well-defined process. And
in some ways, yeah, that makes sense in a way, because it's like, how do you conceptualize designing a musical instrument? It's like, you can't like, it's like writing a symphony. It's like, you can't just like snap your fingers and say, okay, today we're going to start this. It's like, I mean, tell me, like, when you get an idea for a new module or a new innovation, or how long does that bounce around in your brain before you decide, I'm going to do this?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's changed a lot over the years. So if you went back to the times of like doing a module like the Rene, for example, it didn't bounce around for long. It was like the moment the concept occurred to me, I started trying to develop it. Originally, I was using Logic, actually discrete Logic ICs, did the first version of Rene, and then I eventually found a person who could reduce the number of ICs a great deal by coding it for a microcontroller. Back then there just wasn't as many modules out there, so almost anything that wasn't already done by Dieter Doepfer was probably a good idea to chase. If you fast forward to today, generally if I have an idea today, I assume that someone else has already done it. And I go and I look at Modular Grid and see what else is out there. And if, you know, sometimes I look and I see someone's nailed it, you know, like I will look and I'll see, a module from a company like IntelliGel or Tip Top, and I'll look at how they've done it and they nailed it. And it's like, well, this was a cool idea, but yeah, you know, Daniel or Gurr, well, they had the idea already. And not only did they have it, but they did it really, really good. Sometimes you go and you look and you see, well, this person did this, but not the way I would like to see it done. I think it could be done differently or maybe even better. And so then I might continue chasing the idea. But wow, I mean, there is just so much has been done. And I don't think, you know, people talk about the pioneers, you know, they talk about Don Buchla, Bob Moog, Serge, you know, some of the others, you know, I think some of the other companies started chasing. Yeah, EMS, sure, that's a great example, perfect example, actually, of another true pioneer. But then it's like, if you look at Eurorack today, I mean, it isn't the pioneer or the pioneers as in a handful. I mean, there is more pioneers than you could even name off the top of your head. There are so many companies doing so many just radically different developments. I mean, the depth of development in Eurorack is I mean, it's almost unbelievable when you look at it as a whole, not just one company, but as a whole, when you look at it. I mean, the range of development and the different, I mean, it's almost unfathomable for me. I mean, when I think back like 20 years back and I look at what was exciting in a modular synthesizer, and then I think, yeah, I mean, it's just so dramatically different. And yes, you know, Don Buchla and Bob Moog and Serge, and EMS were definitely pioneers in synthesis. But I think Eurorack as a whole is a pioneer on a level that we never even knew was possible. It's just so much. It's so much has happened. It is hard to keep.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Track it at all.
And you guys keep hitting home runs. I mean, like, let's talk about the XPO. That doesn't sound like any other oscillator I've ever heard. You know, and I go way back to the Korg MS-20, which I love that filter, by the way. That's like one of my favorites. And, you know, I mean, I have a long history of messing around with electronic music since the late 80s. And the XPO doesn't sound to me like any other oscillator I've ever heard, with all those different outputs and the ways you can blend them, and with the FM control, and just, I mean, it's just, let's talk about the XPO, because I think that was a total home run.
Oh, you know? Well, thank you. I'm glad you're enjoying it. Yeah, the XPO, so that is an example of, I had an idea. I was laying in bed one night, I couldn't sleep, and I was thinking about different instruments that I enjoy playing. And I was thinking about the OB-8, and I like how you can pan the voices. And I was thinking, how could you get something like that? You know, modular is, I know that there's a lot of polyphonic modules happening today, or trying to happen. But modular itself doesn't really lend itself super well to polyphony.
Polyphony.
For me, I enjoy playing something like the OB-8 more than trying to create polyphony in the modular system. But I still, sure. Something about, you know, how you have this really simple stereophonic effect in the OB-8, it was just really pleasing. And I thought about some different ways that could be achieved. And, you know, the OB-8, I mean, the best thing about it one of the best things about it is the PWM. So I was thinking about PWM, and then I started thinking about how that's a pretty simple circuit, and it would be possible to fit two of them in a fair amount of, you know, a reasonable amount of space, and so on. And so the idea just kind of grew from there of, okay, well, what else can I do? I have stereo, I have two pulse width modulation circuits. What else works with that? And then the oscillator kind of grew into this idea of having a lot of different outputs that you could then blend down, you know, down further down in a mixer, and then go into your filter or whatever. Because again, that's something else that I like in modular. And that even started with the DPO. The DPO has six outputs, which at the time was a lot. These days, maybe not so much, but at the time, six outputs seemed like a lot of outputs.
It's a lot. Yeah.
And so that's one of the nice things about modular, where you can take one oscillator core but process a lot of different outputs from it in different ways. So you build this complex chain of events from a single sequence. Yeah, so you have a single sequence playing, but you're gating it different, each output differently, or you're affecting them differently, or filtering them differently, so that it ends up sounding like more than just a single sequence, the way it would sound if, say,
that's what I love. Yeah. That's exactly what I love about the XPO. I can send, you know, one to like the Q pass. I can send one to like, you know, an Eventide Misha, like to, mm-hmm. you know, have those like triggering each other, like, yeah. And confusing each other. And I mean, it's like, it's really endless. But I love the filter in it. It's like, it's got this, like, especially when you go, I'm looking at my module here. It's the bottom right one. It's the modulate second to the top, but I can't see my, I need glasses. But anyway, the tones that you get out of that, some of the bandpass stuff, it's almost like a 303, but different, you know, just super, super useful, super musical. I'm in love with that module.
Oh, yeah. Are you talking about the QPOS now?
No, I'm talking about the XPO.
Oh, the XPO. Yeah, the bottom right. That's the wave folder, I think, right? The wave folder output? Yeah.
Yeah, yep. That gives you that 303 kind of like growl like sometimes.
Oh, it growls for sure. Yeah, and having two of them, yeah, really can get to be quite the harmonic rainbow. I mean, it is like, it's a lot, but so that's an interesting one.
It's beautiful.
Originally, I had a kind of, it's somewhat classic circuit. It's like a analog super saw type circuit, and it was in stereo. And it sounded good, but the modulation wasn't very dramatic. And that's one of the things that I've always tried, a running theme through Make Noise designs, is I like CV inputs to be pretty dramatic. And that's one of the reasons why I always like to have, as much as possible, attenuverters and attenuators built into the module so that you can dial in more subtle effects as well. And, so that, yeah, that the super saw type sound in stereo, it sounded good, but it didn't modulate very dramatically. And so, but it had a lot of circuitry. So when I pulled it off of the PCB, there was this big empty space. And I thought, well, I mean, there's enough room to throw a dual, you know, a stereo wave folder in. And that's how that ended up being. It was kind of one of the last things I added to it. Honestly, there was two prototypes that didn't even have that on there.
It's my favorite knob on there. I love all of them though. I like taking the mono ones out too. Mm-hmm. Like it's just, I mean, you can, there's a crazy amount of possibilities, you know?
Yeah. When you start mixing them. Yeah. It's definitely, one of the beauties of modular is being able to combine a lot of different signals to have different effects, things you wouldn't think to do, or they just don't let you
sure.
do in most poly instruments, or even mono synths. You know, like in modular, if you want to take gate sequences from three different gate sequencers and merge them all together and send that result somewhere, you can do that, and you might end up with something really interesting
And different. You know, and that's what I love about the possibilities. And Walker is the way his mind works. I can't tell you how many times I've stolen, borrowed philosophies from him, because he almost thinks it as he's doing it. It's just really, really cool.
Yeah, I think so. I think that is a stream of consciousness for sure. Sometimes
from the XPO, this is like so much fun for me, but I want to get on to the Spectrophon, because that's the latest offering from Make Noise, and I haven't gotten too far into it because it's really different, and like everybody that I see doing videos is doing cooler stuff than me on it, so I'm not really there yet. Maybe you can just give us, I know it's crazy, the possibilities. Tell us about the design and how that came to be.
Well, the good thing is that you've got all the time in the world to explore it. So I mean, I always, there's nothing wrong with not understanding something right away, in my opinion, because I think it gives you something
to look
forward to, you know. Later, you can look forward to learning more about it. I am still learning about the Spectrophone. So that was a very long development, and it started with wanting Tom Erb to have a voice module in the system, because all the modules he had done, most of them, there was the Telharmonic, but we weren't making that anymore. But, you know, usually he was doing signal processing, you know, so Mimeophone, Echophone are both more, you know, they're signal processing. Morphogene, I guess you could say, was a voice module, but also that was it was also less his, you know, conceptually, that was not really his, you know, that he it wasn't really his concept. You know, I don't think that was what his idea of a voice in a modular system would be. That was, I mean, to be frank, it was my idea of like what something like that should be. It stemmed from the original, the Phonogene. So I really wanted him to have his voice module. And he presented us with this idea of spectral-based synthesis, where you would feed it a sound, and it would basically look at several frequency bands in the sound and measure those, the energy levels, you could say, and then take those measurements. Those are a text file, basically, and they become a table, I guess, or a guide for an oscillator. And it's extremely abstract, and it took us a really long time to get it into a user interface that made sense from a musical standpoint, as opposed to just from like a scientific standpoint. That was the biggest struggle. You know, his algorithm was up and running pretty quickly, but then it was this thing of, well, how do we do something with this algorithm? And it's, I'll be honest with you, there's still times when I'm using it that I don't fully understand what I'm doing. And that's fine. I mean, I don't need to understand everything. Yeah, it can be a really wonderful place to be.
It's an endless journey.
Exactly.
You know? That's what I love about it.
You know? So I think, you know, the big struggle wasn't, you know, he'd had this idea for this synthesis voice that he wanted to do. The real struggle was figuring out how to make it into a module that could exist in the modular system and be functional in the modular system. And that's
in that size too. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, if you think about like the early Roland stuff, like the 330s and like the, you know, if you get into voice, what do you call it? Vocoder technology.
Oh, yeah.
Those were huge like units.
Yeah,
they were heavy,
yeah.
And there was like, I mean, so the fact that you guys took that concept and made something completely new out of it is just incredible.
Right, yeah. Right. So that's the other piece. Yeah, you really have to distill it into a handful of parameters that modulate well. You can have more parameters, but the more parameters you have, either A, you have to have, you have to spend more money on analog to digital, or B, you end up with parameters that are sluggish when you're doing DSP. And we really don't like that. The sluggish.
Yeah, there must be a lot of there's a lot of calculations going on. So like the fact that everything happens so instantaneously when you turn knobs and stuff, I mean, what kind of DSP goes into something this complex? I mean, it's almost like you have like a, what are those little tiny computers, raspberries? It's almost like you guys have raspberries inside.
So, yeah, no, we never use anything like that. A computer, single board computers, yeah, like the BeagleBone or the Raspberry Pi, those are cool. But the thing that I've seen with those is that they still have to have an operating system on there. So you're running a software on top of an operating system. So
that's more lag.
A little bit. It can be. Yeah, you really, you know, obviously modern computers are so powerful that it doesn't matter. And I'm sure eventually things like the Raspberry Pi will reach that point. So what we use is it's a more general purpose microcontroller, the STM32, which actually a lot of companies in Eurorack use STM32s. It's an ARM, which is a type of processor. They're fairly affordable. Excuse me. They have a lot of pins, which, you know, that's the other thing about modular is there's a lot of IO. So sometimes when you look at digital devices where there's just, you know, a few encoders and a stereo out, you know, those encoders are pretty easy for a computer to read, and you know, you really aren't doing a lot of heavy lifting as far as the IO. But with modular, it's all about the IO. You know, it's a digital device that's existing in an analog environment. So you're still somebody's still patching a cycling math into the input, and they might be changing the cycle rate from 30 seconds to 1 kilohertz. And this, you know, little computer in there has to be tracking that the entire time. And that type of thing does eat up a lot of resources. So the STM32, it's a good it's a good device to use for this type of development. So yeah, that's what we have in there, and it doesn't run software. It runs something called firmware, and the thing about firmware is firmware only does its one thing. So it's a little bit lighter weight than a software running on an operating system. It's more like a software that's just running all the time. So as soon as you power on a Spectraphone or a Mimeophone, it's doing the thing. The Mimeophone only does the Mimeophone, and as soon as you turn it on, it starts doing it as quickly as possible.
I love the Mimeophone, by the way, too. That's like just such a rich, that has such a very analog sound to it.
Well, I'm glad you noticed that. That's something that I like about Tom. So Tom's a little older, and he spent, a good part of his life, he spent playing and listening to analog instruments. I know he's very fond of, for example, the Sequential Pro 1. He had one of those for a long time. But I mean, also, it's just, the guy, he's developing an echo, but this is a person who spent a lot of time using tape echoes or using Bucket Brigade echoes in his own music over the course of his life. So he knows what these things sound like. He knows how it feels to use them. He's not watching a YouTube video of it. He experienced it firsthand. So
it's a different thing.
Yep. Yeah.
And they're rubbery. There's a rubbery kind of like visceral, like gooiness to them. I think it's the old Motorola ones that are like, the ones that they don't make anymore. I forget
the Redicon, isn't it? The Redicon, yeah. SAD, yeah. 1070 or whatever. Yeah.
Like a lot of those, like say the DM, the old, Boss DM1, like it's just this, there's a certain creaminess that's really hard to describe, but I think, when it's done right, it's amazing, and you guys really nailed it on that.
I think him having all that experience in, I think his, just being alive for a long time and playing a lot of analog stuff has given him a good appreciation for that. And so he, something that Tom thinks about a lot is saturation, for example. Even in instances where saturation might not even seem like it matters, he's still thinking about it. And I think the reason for that is that he knows that, in an old mixing console, for example, sometimes, the saturation in an EQ or in a, in the bus, the master bus or on the front end can be very helpful, can be forgiving in a way that can make it easier to get good sounds. Yeah. And so I think he spends a lot of time. Exactly. Yeah. I think he spends a lot of time thinking about, how to use saturation in the digital realm in order to make these somewhat unforgiving processes a little more forgiving, because that's really what makes the Mimeophone so fun, is that it's a very forgiving digital delay. It's harder to make it sound bad, which is what you want in an echo, because an echo is usually not the source of your musical flow. It's usually something that you're applying, and so if it's obstructing that path, if it's obstructing the musical flow, it's become useless. So I think having an echo that fits easily into what you're doing can be very, very helpful.
That's cool. Yeah, there's a modern take on saturation seems to get skewed. Like there's so many things that come out saying, like emulating vinyl, for instance, and it'll be like, it makes me seasick when I listen to it. I'm like, well, the only records that ever sounded like that were the ones that you left in your car in the sun, So it's funny how over time, like the perception of what analog, quote unquote, it's like, it's funny because I bring this up almost every episode, and I'm slowly getting used to like the cassette audio, wave that a lot of these young people are getting into, and some people are doing some really amazing things in it, but sometimes I just can't resist commenting on their Instagram posts like, oh, we used to have a guy in a white lab coat that would fix that. There was a lot to do with analog that wasn't ugly and distorted, it's like,
absolutely,
and I think that's what you're talking about. There's complexities that are way more detailed than that. It's not as simple as just saturating it to the point where it's, you know, distorted. But anyway, that's me, you know, up on my soapbox being the old dude. I'm into like all this stuff, and you know, it's just been, you know, I want to have you back sometime with Walker, and I think it would be fun to do a one where we film it and like maybe do some live stuff, like we're, you know, like a workshop kind of thing, like in real time. Wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah,
something like
sure.
That?
Yeah.
I think I'm just so into this, and it's like we've got like a really beefy double episode here, and I feel like we kind of just scratched the surface of stuff. I mean, we went from the Wobble Bug all the way up to the XPO and the Spectrophon. So, you know, I definitely want to have you back, and I just wanted to thank you so much for being here today. And I could do another 2 hours. But, I've got a session here in 3 minutes ago.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I don't want to hold you up.
No. I just wanted to tell you that I'm just so excited and blown away by everything.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. Thanks for having me. I hope you have a good recording session.
Yeah, man. Let's keep in touch. I'd love to keep this going because I think we have a whole little subculture of people that are going to really dig this. Going to wrap it up with Moonlit Through a Veil of Smoke, another track from Tony's incredible modular album, Breakin' is a Memory. Anthony J. Resta signing off. Studio Secrets A to Z. See you next time.